Today, my guest is Dr. Tracy Vaillancourt. Dr. Vaillancourt is a Tier 1 Canada Research Chair in school-based mental health and violence prevention at the University of Ottawa, where she is cross-appointed as a full professor in counseling psychology, Faculty of Education, and the School of Psychology, Faculty of Social Sciences. Dr. Vaillancourt is also a member of the Brain and Mind Institute, Faculty of Medicine, and the Center for Health, Law, Policy, and Ethics, Faculty of Law at U Ottawa. She is the president of the International Society for Research on Aggression, a fellow and chair of the COVID-19 Task Force for the Royal Society of Canada, and the chief editor of Frontiers in Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, Child Mental Health and Interventions. Thanks for joining me today, Dr. Vaillancourt.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, I've been excited to have this conversation. I know you've spoken about the topic of competition and aggression and intrasexual aggression, and I wanted to pick your brain about some things that I've been exploring for this podcast. The focus, the general topic, is about shame, and my idea is that shame can be helpful in terms of us maybe correcting behavior, maybe very advanced or aggressive behavior. But overall, I just personally feel like shame isn't that useful because it usually hangs around with us for a long time, you know, feeling that we're not worthy enough, feeling that we're not good enough. So it was something that I wanted to explore through the podcast, how to help people understand what shame is and then promote the idea of letting it go from our lives and, you know, using various tools and processes to do that. The other side of the coin for me is that I was curious about exploring the idea of competing, why we compete with each other. And in my mind, it's not really useful to compete in terms of sort of the, I guess, the bigger picture, or maybe the idea, the greater idea that we're all unique, we're all individuals, we all have something unique to contribute to the world, our gifts, our talents. So why compare, why compete when kind of the idea that no two snowflakes are the same? We can never each be exactly the same, even if we have similar interests. So that was something I thought you and I could speak more about, was what is the basis of competition, the evolutionary aspects of it, and why it seems to be prevalent, especially among women. Those are the reasons why I wanted to invite you, and I thought you will have a lot to lend to the topic. Does that sound good?
That sounds great.
Okay, awesome. Well, I wanted to first ask, what inspired you to choose studying bullying and competition, especially in regard to girls and women?
So I get asked this question a lot, and sometimes people want there to be a sad story attached to it, where I was bullied and therefore I wanted to study bullying, that sort of thing. I think it actually, there is a story attached to it. I've always been really interested in the hierarchies amongst youth. And so when I was, even when I was in high school and a teenager, I was really interested in how things unfolded and why some kids were popular and other kids weren't. So I think I was a budding social psychologist or social scientist when I was a teenager. So, you know, the interest was there. When I was in graduate school, I would go to conferences and people would talk about peer relationships and they would talk about popular kids and they would say that these kids were really pro-social and had a lot of, so not just pro-social, but had a lot of assets and attributes that, you know, made them very likable. And that just didn't fit with my reality of high school. And so I think what happened was, and well, I know what happened is that social scientists were using the label popular to mean kids who are well-liked. And in high school, young people were using the term popular to mean those that were high on visibility and influence and not necessarily quite liked. So I was really keen on figuring that out. And I also remember going to conferences when I was a young graduate student and people would talk about relational aggression, which is what I study. It's also called indirect aggression. So the backstabbing, you know, the rumor spreading, the peer group exclusion, that sort of thing. And then we talk about how the kids who use this were invariably maladjusted and rejected. And I thought that doesn't fit either, because the kids who used it in my high school were the most popular kids. Again, not that social liking kind of thing, pro-social kid. They were controversial. So I was really keen on studying popular kids and kind of debunking some of the viewpoints that were held when I was a graduate student. And I just want to preface this. I think that, and this is going to sound a little bit mean on my end, but I think a lot of them held this viewpoint because they weren't in the popular group and they weren't, you know, so I think that there is a little bit of a nerdy academic profile. And so maybe they weren't part of that group and weren't as in, or and weren't as interested in that group, but I was very interested in that group and I was part of that group. So I wanted to study it. So I basically did my PhD on Mean Girls before Mean Girls came out.
Hey, it makes sense. Yeah. No, and I was not expecting a sad story. I just,
yeah, a lot of people want it though.
I get that. You know, it's just curious why this is such a particular topic, but it's something that it seems universal. I'm wondering, is this universal in your research in terms of
It's universal. And I speak to women from all over the world. I travel a lot for my job. Women all over the world behave the same way that we do in North America. So it's been documented around the world as well, even when cultural norms are quite different from what we have in California and Ontario. Yeah, so it is a universal.
When it comes to competition among females, what are the factors that contribute to that? And how does that differ from males, if it does?
It does differ from men and boys. And I mean, the Super Bowl was played yesterday, and you see that there's this, you know, the competition is readily apparent. It's rewarded. There's a lot of excitement around it. So there's this expectation that men are competitive and will be rewarded for their competitive behavior. We saw Travis Kelce go after his coach on the sideline. If a woman ever did that, her career would be over, that sort of thing. So in any event, there are differences. And I think that a lot of this is born from the idea that, first of all, there's an innate component to it. So this is part of the human condition. So it's not that men are the only ones who are competitive. Women are competitive too, but it's just expressed differently and it's tolerated differently by society. So the idea here for women is that there's a scarcity of resources, and it's always been the case. So our livelihood, our life, and that of our offspring has been connected to securing resources for ourselves and for our children. And because the amount of resources going around is not infinite, competition will ensue, making sure that you get resources, that your children get resources, and that will then ensure their livelihood and their longevity and their life. And then your genes get passed along so that that trait for competitiveness and being successful by being competitive then continues on. But the manifestation of it is so different because there's a very low tolerance for us behaving like Travis Kelce did in the Super Bowl yesterday. And we have this mix where we have to get along and we need the support of other women to help manage resources and the like, but we also have to get ahead. So it's like this mix of like belonging, but competing. And because of that, its expression now is more circuitous and indirect. Whereas with men, it's right in your face and that's accepted and tolerated.
Right. I'm curious about your take on this sort of bigger picture thinking, backing up to competition and the origins. It seems to me that that comes from the survival instinct, right?
Yes.
In terms of why we have to compete or why that would be part of the reality, the limited resources and getting ahead. I'm just wondering if there is an innate part of us that just knows how to use instinct, our skills, our instincts.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, is this also in and of itself an evolutionary phenomenon? In other words, do you imagine that our species won't have to, at least in the social context, operate from this place of competition? Like, in other words, I'm wondering, do you see survival as almost like a culture in and of itself that we have been a part of, but does it always have to be a part of how we operate? I don't know if that makes sense, what I'm trying to ask.
I do know. I think I understand what you're saying. So it kind of seems misplaced when we have a lot of resources. So in modern society, there's a lot of resources, but we have to keep in mind that in a sense, we're holding our North American viewpoint, because there's a lot of resources in our countries, but there's not a lot of resources for all women and all children around the world. So it still exists. And, you know, and then why is it still continuing, though, in places where there are a lot of resources? Is this then just a vestige of our ancestors' traits being passed along and the like? And I think that even though we have a lot of resources in North America, there's still a zero-sum game component to it. So there's not all women are occupying the top of the economic ladder. I'm a university professor and I'm a tier one Canada research chair, and it's predominantly men. So, you know, there's still this perception that there's not a lot of resources, even when there are resources. So maybe you and I are eating today and we're going to eat tomorrow and we're not worried about that, but there's still the opportunities for women are still different. And so I think we still end up feeling competitive because there's this perception that there's not enough resources, even though those basic resources are now met, like we are fed and clothed and housed for the most part in economically advanced countries like the ones we live in. So yeah, so it's kind of hard because we have this old brain in a modern context. And so why does something persist? I think this will always persist. I think that it's so part of the human condition that even if we had equality around the world, economic equality, we'd still see it.
I hear you. Okay. So in the social context of women, and not even specifically maybe in the workplace, but just out in the world, relating, socializing, connecting, you know, building bonds, why is there still competition amongst women, even if, and maybe the answer is that it's the evolutionary instinct or the basis of who we are, but why is there still competition, even in a social setting? Is that because on some level, we're actually still competing for mates, even though we're just hanging out, chatting, yeah, getting to know each other? What is it that brings that out in women who are just simply, I'm going to put in quotes, simply socializing?
I think this is the hard part to swallow for a lot of women, because I'm a feminist, you know, and I want women to succeed. And I love women. I have, you know, I have tons of great friends. I don't feel like I'm competing with them. I'm not saying I've never competed with them. I'd be a hypocrite if I said that. So I think it's a hard one to swallow because, you know, we want to say that we're past like this innate part of ourselves, that we're bigger than that, we're better than that. But there's so many examples of how we revert back to who we are at our core, right? And who our ancestors were and how they've influenced us. So it's there, and but it's also attenuated or not based on socialization. So, you know, at the end of the day, we don't punch each other in the face because we're socialized to not. We understand that the costs are going to be enormous, but we are not socialized out of using indirect aggression. So I've shown this empirically in several different studies where we're really good at getting little kids early in their life to understand that you don't hit your friends, but we're not good at all at getting them to recognize that it's hurtful to exclude somebody. It's hurtful to talk about somebody behind their back, those sorts of things. And so our studies have shown that physical aggression gets replaced by indirect aggression. And that replacement is actually socialization. So here you have this, and physical aggression, by the way, has an innate component to it as well. Mm-hmm. Aggression is part of the human condition, all forms of aggression. So we see little kids are very aggressive in their toddlerhood. I don't know if you have children, but if you do, they beat the heck out of you until they're about 3 years old. And then they start replacing that that innate aggressive tendency with another type of aggression. And then as a society, we tolerate it. And then this type of aggression persists across the lifespan. So I was just visiting my best friend's mother with her at a seniors complex. And, you know, the little old ladies were talking about other little old ladies in the complex. So how is that? Like, what are they competing for at that age? Like, what is going on? Why does this still exist? So part of it will be that combination of it's part of who we are. It's at the core of being human. There's also a socialization component to it.
Right. And the point you were, I think, emphasizing just a bit ago about being a feminist, and but that women, there may be this idea or perception that women are in a good place in terms of the sisterhood, if you will. We believe that we, at least that's what I heard you say, we might believe that we are in a really good place, that we're not competing, that we're completely supportive of each other, that we're positive and, not in this sense of aggression that we were mm-hmm. exploring. Are you saying that there, more women really are maybe more aggressive or indirectly aggressive than they realize? Is this something that a lot of women may not even realize, that they're expressing indirect aggression?
That, and also that in the right context, I can get almost every woman on the planet to behave inappropriately in this way.
I've heard you talk about your studies.
Yeah, I'm so sure of it. So yeah, so you might be really well self-regulated. You might be really good at keeping the jealousy at bay and not competing with others. So you may be really, you've worked really hard. You really think you are, you know, the best supporter of women. And yet if a woman says something that you don't approve of, because whatever it is, so your morals don't align, we'll see this come out. It happens. Like, so we did a huge study of 1,100 women, and we asked them, like, how often in the past year did you do? And we asked them, like, 25 different behaviors that are consistent with indirect aggression. And only 5% said that they hadn't done any of it in the past year. And I think those 5% were lying. I've heard Mother Teresa wasn't even all that nice. So I think we, in the right context, we all are a little bit, we all have the capacity to aggress against others. And this form of aggression is socially accepted. So, you know, in the right context, I can't get everybody to be physically aggressive. There's no way. Or perhaps not even verbally aggressive. But in the right context, I could get people to be indirectly aggressive.
Would you give some examples of indirect aggression so the audience understands?
So it takes like a lot of different forms, but commonly it's about talking bad about somebody, excluding them from the group. Sometimes it also involves non-verbal derisive gestures. So you're wearing an outfit that I think is too sexually provocative, and I'll give you the once over. I'll look you up and down and then just look at you with disgust or disdain. And that conveys my contempt for your outfit, those sorts of things. Oftentimes, though, it's about putting somebody down to a third party. So feminists who have problems with my work oftentimes will still criticize me. You're allowed to criticize me, but in a personalized way. So, you know, the irony is they're criticizing me for saying that all women have the capacity to be indirectly aggressive, and then they use indirect aggression against me to make their point.
So they're not even criticizing the work, they're criticizing you.
Exactly. You can criticize the work, but it becomes personalized.
I see. Well, this all, and I know you're saying this is, you know, really innate. It's innate, but it's also socialized.
Yeah.
And I think I'm so interested in the social part of it, because obviously I can't really influence people's innate responses or, you know, the evolutionary kind of basis for those innate reactions. But I'm interested in the social part of things in terms of helping women maybe wake up to this, because indirect aggression, I believe many times, maybe not always, can be so subconscious, right? We don't even realize. We may realize we're not being as nice as we could be, but we don't realize that this is something necessarily that we have a choice I guess that's what I want to say is we have a choice to behave indirectly or not. And I'm wondering consciously, what is it that can be done to help with kind of evolving our socialization? No, is there anything? And I know you've studied, you know, young girls in school, and I'm just curious how to frame this in a way where we can start to just really talk about this, keep it real.
So that's basically the end of my book is that's going to be forthcoming called Mean. It's going to be published by Simon & Schuster. It's really like, okay, so if this happens, like, so what? What do we do about it? And I think there's a lot of different things that we could do about it. So first of all, we could recognize why the behavior exists. So we do things because it serves a function. So if you do something that I find offensive, studies have shown women's brains, we react immediately. We react more quickly to these slights than men. Then there's a couple ways I could repair it. So I could turn that back on me and become depressed or anxious, which isn't a really good adaptive way of repairing, right? Blaming myself for how maybe you treated me poorly or how I felt you didn't do right by me. Or I can attack the source of this discomfort. So as soon as we hang up, I can go talk to my graduate students and say, I can't believe what a ridiculous question she asked. Can you believe she said that? I can get my sisterhood to support me and then I feel better. So those are like, that's the outcome, like the behavioral manifestation of that first hurt. Or I could back it up and try and recognize why that hurt. And like try and manage the situation in the immediate. The problem is that we don't do that as women because that inevitably leads to 3-week silent treatment, peer group exclusion, my friends taking my side, you know, you being mocked, you being victimized. So we need to have frank discussions. We need to be able to not agree with each other and it not be the end of the world. We need to be a little less sensitive. And then if we can then back that up where we don't get to those behavioral manifestation, if we could back it up in the immediate where you say something and I don't like it. And I say, Tiffany, can you just like explain yourself a little bit more? Cause I'm feeling like a little bit hurt by what's happening. Like I'm, you know, like this is how I'm hearing it. And then you can then repair it and say, oh no, oh my goodness, that's not at all what I meant, or yeah, that is what I meant. And this is why I meant it, you know, but we can't have those discussions. And that is, I think, one of the hugest issues is that how do you get ahead if you can't speak truth to each other? And, you know, Mr. Rogers, of all people, said, if it's mentionable, it's manageable.
Yes.
And I have a lot of good girlfriends. I have a few good girlfriends that it is so authentic that we just say what we feel and we say what we mean. But for the most part, my friendships are good, but not 100% truthful. Because if I told them how I felt, it wouldn't be received well. So we let things go for the sake of the relationship, or we make ourselves smaller for the sake of the relationship. Or we disengage from the relationship because somebody has slighted us instead of doing the work to repair that. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And what you're saying is sparking this idea. It's maybe it's adjacent to competition, but, and I don't know if your work speaks to this, but I'm sure you can just as a human speak to this, like this idea of competition. But then there's like comparing and competition. I don't know if they're linked. In other words,
they're 100% linked.
We do this silently often, you know, we look at someone and maybe it's a woman looking at another woman and it may not even fully be conscious, but we think, gosh, they've got it going on or they've got this opportunity. And like, why don't I have this opportunity? We feel less than and we compare. And I think that that's maybe a very particular aspect of this topic that I'm interested in is that coming also from a place of competition when we compare? It's like I think when we compare in my mind, it's coming from this, also this place of scarcity. Well, how come they have this opportunity? Why are they shining? I want to feel that, or I want to have those opportunities and I don't right now. That to me is a very dangerous also mentality, but it seems like it's also maybe a part of our innate, I don't like that it is, but it feels like that it's a part of our innate reality or our innate mm-hmm. instincts. And I wonder if there's a way to parse it out or explain how those feed each other.
So we actually did a study on this.
Oh, okay.
So we published a study and we looked at this because I coach high performance athletes. So I'm a soccer coach. I'm the head coach of the Ontario team for the U17s. So our province is the biggest province in Canada. So the girls that are on my team are representing Canada at the senior level. They're fantastic players. So what I've always noticed, though, is that because it is a zero-sum game, there's only 11 starting positions, that it's hard to manage that. So you're in a context of direct competition, but also having to be good teammates. And so one thing I know that we all do, and not just women, but men do too, we make social comparisons, and they're going to be upward or they're going to be downward. And when we make a comparison that doesn't make us feel good about ourselves, we repair it in the way that I just explained. We can turn it on ourselves and say, why am I such a loser? You know, become anxious, depressed, that sort of thing, debase our self-esteem. Or we can say, make up a narrative of why they're succeeding and put them down. And so we followed a really large group of adolescents from the time they were in grade 9, which is the beginning of high school, until grade 12. And we looked at this evolution, like the temporal priority, like what came first. And so what we found was that social comparisons where you're falling short elicit jealousy. That jealousy is then repaired by using indirect aggression. And it's stronger for girls than for boys. So we're constantly scanning women. We're constantly making comparisons. And this is actually usually good for our self-esteem. And it's good at, you know, it serves a function of also motivating you to be a little bit better, right? But when you don't feel good, so like part of the human condition is also to have good self-esteem. People who, you know, most people have good self-esteem. And the way we maintain our good self-esteem is by repairing these comparisons. So we repair the comparisons by putting down the target. So if we compare, if I compare myself to, well, why did this person just get this big grant? And I was also in that competition and it's another woman who's of similar age, and I will try and repair this, like, because this hurts because I wasn't successful. So normally people with good self-esteem will then land on something that's wrong with the individual who had succeeded.